We're busy rearranging the schedule. We have been smiled on. It's here, which means tonight we'll get to watch the Olivier Othello. So we're putting off the opera probably till next week, and not exactly sure how we're going to arrange it. Everything's in flux, but it's for a good reason. It's here. So tonight we'll be watching this. I need to check. I think it is long, so I'll need to check the time, and we'll decide on a starting time. But I am delighted. This is kind of nice. They put these little quotations from the reviews on the outside to whet the viewer's appetite. Emotionally overwhelming, one of the greatest displays of an actor's imagination in the history of movies. So I would agree with that. So that's tonight. That's tonight. What will happen, we'll open it up and it will be, you know, they will have stuck the wrong film in the box, and what we'll have is The Sound of Music. And the devil will be chuckling, just chuckling. The point was made after the first lecture, and I think it's a very good one. Let me just state it. It's what I was implying and didn't come directly out and say, but it's a fact. In that soliloquy of Iago, in which he says, "I will now take virtue and turn it to evil," we of course have the inversion of what God does, who is able to take evil and bring good out of it. And again, what you see here is the demonic order is always inversion. We have the frightening fact in this play that inversion includes taking virtue and bringing evil from it. And he says quite openly, he knows that's what he is doing. That's what he is intending to do. Now, what I want to do in this hour is simply chronicle the process. In Act 3, Othello is ensnared. The two images that Iago has used earlier, first of the web that will catch the fly, and then of the net that will ensnare them all. Those two images become realized in the action of the third act. There should be absolutely no surprises in what happens. So I just want to go through and show you how it happens. And Shakespeare has designed the play this way, that we are not being surprised by what we're witnessing. He's quite capable of that. It happens in many plays where we see something take an unexpected twist. What he is doing in Act 3 is simply now working out everything that we have been told and shown, and we are made very uneasy by the fact that Iago is able to make it run so smoothly. In current slang, he's greased the skids, and therefore the thing just slides along smoothly. And part of the pity and fear we feel, in the Aristotelian terms, watching this happen that we knew was going to happen, and now we see it going forward. And in fact, what I want to do is start Act 3, Scene 3. There are a couple of very brief scenes that begin Act 3 that are interesting, and if we were doing an entire semester study of Othello, we'd pause on them, but we don't have time, so I'm rushing forward. Act 3, Scene 3. You'll notice, and again, this is Shakespeare at his best. We are on Cyprus, but if much of Act Two took place on the shore or in front of the palace, we are now on the citadel. This is happening on the ramparts. We are on the high point. This is not, again, not accidental. We are up above. We are going to watch our hero fall from a high place. He has been raised up, in a sense. This is taking place on the citadel. The scene begins very simply and very gently with the working out of that virtue that we were told about, and that is Desdemona assuring Cassio that she will intercede for him. Be thou assured, good Cassio, I will do all my abilities in thy behalf. Good madam, do, I warrant it grieves, it's Amelia, excuse me. Good madam, do, I warrant it grieves my husband as if the cause were his. The wife does not know her own husband. Desdemona, oh, that's an honest fellow. She's speaking of Iago. Do not doubt, Cassio, but I will have my lord and you again as friendly as you were. Bounteous madam, whatever shall become of Michael Cassio, he's never anything but your true servant. I know it. I thank you. You do love my lord. We have good service, but we're back to that notion again. Iago's vision of the good servant who's the fool for loyally following the master. And will come to ruin. And he's going to prove that. Cassio will come to ruin. But Cassio is as good as his word. He never speaks against Othello or Desdemona. He is as good as his word. But out of that simple little seed, again, Shakespeare begins the scene with that little, I would call it a seed of virtue. Decent people engaged in decent conversation, one trying to help the other. It's an act of charity. That's where we begin. Enter Othello and Iago at a distance. I'm at line about 30. Madam, here comes my lord. Madam, I'll take my leave, says Cassio. Why stay and hear me speak? Madam, not now. I'm very ill at ease, unfit for mine own purposes. Desdemona says, well, do your discretion. And Cassio leaves. He's too uncomfortable. He doesn't want to confront Othello right now. He is embarrassed. He is embarrassed. He feels he's done something wrong and he doesn't want to be there. It is typical human feeling. It is quite understandable. Iago says, ha, I like not that. We begin. Nothing has happened. Cassio has simply left the scene. Ha, I like not that. What dost thou say? Oh, nothing, my lord. Or, if, I know not what. He's brilliant. Was not that Cassio parted from my wife? Cassio, my lord? No, sure. I cannot think it that he would steal away so guilty-like, seeing your coming. You're all laughing. Notice what has happened here. Notice what has happened here. We as audience, this is the glory of drama. This is the glory of drama. We as audience have just witnessed this scene. Shakespeare plays out the little scene. It happens in action. Then two other characters come in, and suddenly Iago begins to take control of the stage. And he is now forcing Othello to see the same scene through Iago's eyes. Iago's in control. What we have is interpretation. What we have is interpretation. It is possible to take that which is simple and direct and misinterpret it. It is possible for critics to read Othello, go into the classroom and teach young students that Othello is an attack upon patriarchy. That Othello is a brilliant example of the horrible stultifying nature of civilization and particularly Catholic civilization as embodied in Venice, and that's how they're teaching it. And those students sitting in the classroom will sit down and take those notes. And they'll write it down. And what is happening is essentially the same kind of evil going on at this moment. We take the play Othello and we suddenly see it through the eyes of a professor who hates Catholicism, who hates civilization, who hates Shakespeare. This is what's happening in the play. We take a scene of simple virtue, and Othello is now getting it through the eyes of Iago, who hates beauty, who hates virtue, who hates truth. And we have to always be aware that as we go through the world, we are constantly subject to interpretation. People telling us things. Which takes me back to authority, patriarchy. The play is saying you must have a good, honest, decent, upright authority in charge who will speak to you directly and clearly and tell you the truth. That you can trust so that you may have civilized order. We need to be at that moment where Brabantio can say, I don't have to worry about thieves. My house is not a grange. I live in Venice. And I can trust in that. But once the disorder starts, once it begins to be pulled apart, once people begin attempting to assert the self against that rule of authority, we're left wide open. Here it is. Ha, I like not that. What dost thou say? Nothing, my lord, or if, I know not what. Was not that Cassio parted from my wife? Cassio, my lord? No, sure. I cannot think it that he would steal away so guilty like seeing your coming. I do believe 'twas he. Desdemona walks up and what does she talk about? Cassio. What does she say? She appeals to Othello on behalf of Cassio. What's the subject of the whole conversation? Cassio. Not now, sweet Desdemona, some other time. No, I don't want to talk about this right now. Why the first seeds, just a seed. What's going on? Something's going on, I don't understand. Why doesn't Othello understand? Because he's an outsider. He has always been a bit uneasy, not picking up on things that others pick up on, because he's a Moor. He's the Moor of Venice. I don't quite understand, I'm a step behind. Where is he self-assured? Where is he comfortable? On the battlefield. He's never going to fight again. Where is the soldier not comfortable? In this hyper-civilized, very courteous society where there are little signs and signals and courtesy. He doesn't know what's going on there. That's not how he won his wife. He won her through direct wooing, talking about his adventures and battles. And she keeps pushing it and pushing it. Gently, but she's pushing it because Desdemona always wants her way. How do we know that? Look how the play began. She gets her way. Desdemona gets her way. She insists on it. Prithee no more. Let him come when he will. I will deny thee nothing, which is what Iago counted on. She finally wins him back over. He's comfortable. She leaves, but notice what comes out of his mouth. Extraordinary lines. Excellent wretch. Wretch is a term of fondness. It does not have our negative connotation. Okay. At the time, it meant a term of endearment. Excellent wretch, perdition catch my soul, but I do love thee. And when I love thee not, chaos is come again. Well, again, the greatest poetry, you know, you can't comment on it. You just have to let it. There it is. My noble lord, what dost thou say, Iago? Did Michael Cassio, when you wooed my lady, know of your love? He did from first to last. Why dost thou ask? But for a satisfaction of my thought, no further harm. The language. We define ourselves by language. We move others by language. We manipulate by language. Why of thy thought, Iago? I did not think he had been acquainted with her. Oh, yes, and went between us very oft. Indeed. Indeed, discernest thou aught in that? What's he picking up on? The tone, the hints, there's nothing there. Notice. Who's doing the work? Othello. What's Iago saying? Nothing. Hint, tone of voice, hint. He's saying nothing. Who's doing the work? Othello. He set it up. All he has to do, drop a hint and watch Othello's imagination start running. Is he not honest, says Othello? Honest, my lord? Honest, I honest, my lord, for aught I know. What dost thou think? Think, my lord? Think, my lord, by heaven thou echoest me. Okay. But what have we got? Yeah, we've got echoes. We've got echoes. Who's speaking? Who's echoing? Who's the mirror? Who's the reflected image? This is haunting, frightening stuff, because there's really nothing going on. They're not talking about anything. Hints, suggestions. But that's how slander gets spread. Well, you know who I saw him with. Who? You'll never guess who I saw. Who? Father Dorn was saying he's absolutely right. The greatest instrument of slander and gossip now is the telephone. Imagine what Iago could have done if he'd had a telephone. Or better yet, was on the internet. Click a few little things in and send them out. Whee! And watch it all happen. Reason being, I mean, even there, notice, all he's giving to Othello now, he is not saying, I suspect your wife with Cassio. He's not saying, he doesn't have to say that. Hints, hints, hints. Tone of voice, that's enough. That's how this is how the vice works. This is how slander works. Othello explodes, okay? By heaven, thou echoest me as if there were some monster in thy thought too hideous to be shown. Notice, who's doing the work? Othello's saying, you seem to have a monster in your thought. How does he know it's a monster? Iago hasn't said anything. Othello's doing the work. Thou dost mean something. I heard thee say even now, thou likest not that when Cassio left my wife. What didst not like? And when I told thee he was of my counsel, of my whole course of wooing, thou criedest, indeed. And didst contract and purse thy brow together, as if thou then hadst shut up in thy brain some horrible conceit. If thou dost love me, show me thy thought. My lord, you know I love you. He does not obey the command. Othello, who is his commanding officer, gives a command. Tell me what you're thinking. And Iago says what? You know I love you. He disobeys a direct command. And he does it by, instead of following the command, saying what? I'm a good, loyal, obedient servant. So in disobeying, he flatters and gets away with it. I think thou dost. And for I know thou art full of love and honesty and weighest thy words before thou givest them breath. Therefore, these stops of thine fright me the more. For such things in a false, disloyal knave are tricks of custom. That's what they are here. But in a man that's just, there are close dilations working from the heart that passion cannot rule, which is also true. He's just misjudged which kind of man he has before him. For Michael Cassio, I dare be sworn, I think that he is honest. I think so too, Othello says. Men should be what they seem, says Iago. Oh, it's, you know. At this point, notice, at this point, if you're in the audience, you want to throw things at him. We have now really gone beyond all the boundaries. Or those that be not would, they might seem none. Certain men should be what they seem. Why then I think Cassio's an honest man. We're not getting anywhere in terms of conversation, but notice, Iago said earlier, this guy's not too bright. Notice what Iago's doing to Othello's mind. He's playing word games, he's playing mind games, and this poor man's getting befuddled. Nay, yet there's more in this. I prithee, speak to me as to thy thinkings, as thou dost ruminate, and give thy worst of thoughts the worst of words. Tell me the worst, tell me the worst. There's something in there. What is it? It's a monster. Let it out. Good, my lord, pardon me. Though I am bound to every act of duty, he's just disobeyed. Though I am bound to every act of duty, I am not bound to that all slaves are free to. Utter my thoughts? Why, say they are vile and false, as where's that palace whereinto foul things sometimes intrude not? My mind's a palace, he says, but even foul things come into palaces sometimes. Who has that breast so pure but some uncleanly apprehensions keep leets and law days and in session sit with meditations lawful? Thou dost conspire against thy friend Iago if thou but think'st him wronged and makest his ear a stranger to thy thoughts. You've got to tell me, if you're my friend, you've got... Tell me. What's happening? He is doing what he does best. That is Iago. He is arousing passion. He is arousing passion. He's discombobulating reason and simultaneously arousing passion. We are not, notice, it is not that Iago tells a lie and gets Othello. It's what Iago does to Othello, a process that gets the man so disoriented that he's not thinking clearly. And the passions are getting worked up. And Iago goes on and moralizes for about another 30 lines. I'm not going to go through it. Okay? And then comes the warning, line about 165. Othello still screamed, by heaven, I'll know thy thoughts. Iago still hasn't. And now we get the sort of large abstract warning, oh, beware, my lord, of jealousy. Now we mention the general subject. It is the green-eyed monster which doth mock the mead it feeds on. The cuckold lives in bliss, who certain of his fate loves not his wronger. But oh, what damned minutes tells he o'er, who dotes, yet doubts, suspects, yet fondly loves. It's too horrible to go through. Why is this? Think'st thou I'd make a life of jealousy? To follow still the changes of the moon with fresh suspicions? No. To be once in doubt is to be resolved. This is a man of action. Othello is a man of action. What? You think I... No. If this is true... What? If what's true? Iago has said nothing. It's just hint. But Othello's mind is just... Othello's doing the work. No, to be once in doubt is to be resolved. Exchange me for a goat when I shall turn the business of my soul to such exsufflicate and blown surmises matching thy inference. Whose language has he just picked up? Iago's. The animal imagery enters into Othello's mouth. 'Tis not to make me jealous to say my wife is fair, feeds well, appetite right away. She's beautiful, he says first. The second thing he says is, she has a good appetite. What's on his mind, we know. Loves company, is free of speech, sings, plays, and dances. Where virtue is, these are more virtuous. There's nothing wrong with any of this. Nor from mine own weak merits will I draw the smallest fear or doubt of her revolt. He is the one who first says it. Iago has said nothing about Desdemona being unfaithful or revolting against Othello. He has not said it. Othello is the first to name it. But he says it in the context, nor from mine own weak merits will I draw the smallest fear or doubt of her revolt, for she had eyes and chose me. She loved me. How could she revolt? How could she revolt? She loved me. Wait a minute. In loving him, what did she do? Revolted against her father. Look to her more, if thou hast eyes to see. She has deceived her father, and may thee. What's coming back? The facts of the case. Revolt? She wouldn't revolt against me. She revolted against her father. No, Iago, I'll see before I doubt. When I doubt, prove, and on the proof there is no more but this. Away at once with love or jealousy. I am glad of this, for now I shall have reason to show the love and duty that I bear you with franker spirit. Therefore, as I am bound, receive it from me. I speak not yet of proof. Now he's picking up Othello's language. Oh, you said you want proof? You won't act without proof? Oh, I'm not talking about proof yet. Look to your wife, observe her well with Cassio, wear your eye thus, not jealous, nor secure. I would not have your free and noble nature out of self-bounty be abused. Look to it. I know our country disposition well. In Venice, they do let heaven see the pranks they dare not show their husbands. Their best conscience is not to leave it undone, but kept unknown. Notice the game. Notice the game. No, I'm not talking about proof, but you probably should doubt. Now, you're not from Venice. You don't know Venice. You don't know Venetian women. But I'm a Venetian, and I know these women very well. So let me just tell you this. I'll just give you some advice. Okay? They look great. They're very open. They're just like your wife, who is a Venetian woman. But they'll do awful things. They just won't let their husbands know. They'll do it in the face of heaven, but they won't let their husbands know. And therefore, you better be cautious. Your best conscience is not to leave it undone, but keep it unknown. They go ahead and do these things. They just don't let their husbands know it. And of course, I hate to tell you this, you know, you're not a Venetian, you won't see it, but I'm a Venetian, I know it, therefore, you better keep an eye out, dummy. I'm your friend, I'm telling you this. Nobody else would tell you this. If you were a Venetian, you'd know this, but you're a Moor. You're the Moor of Venice, so you can't know this. Look at the response. Breaks your heart. Othello says, "Dost thou say so? She did deceive her father, marrying you." Fact. She did deceive her father, marrying you. And when she seemed to shake and fear your looks, she loved them most. Remember when you were telling her those stories about being with the cannibals and the anthropophagi, and she seemed to be so scared. She wasn't scared. She was loving you. She wanted you to woo her. She wanted to marry you. Don't trust her a bit. That's all external. She's a phony. She was phony to you when she fell in love with you. She was phony to her father when she ran off with you. She may be phony now in fooling around with other men, but just not letting you know. She did deceive her father marrying you, and when she seemed to shake and fear your look, she loved them most. And so she did. The end. Example A, true. Example B, true. Example C, you decide. And Othello says what? True. Why go to them? She that so young could give out such a seeming, to seal her father's eyes up close as oak. Remember that oak image? Remember those ribs of oak on those ships that the storm of nature could crush? There's her father's eyes sealed up like covered over with oak, and his daughter crushing him. He thought 'twas witchcraft, but I am much to blame. I humbly do beseech you of your pardon for too much loving you. I never should have told you all this, except I'm such a good friend. I love you so much. I told you what no other friend would tell you. This is the oldest ploy in the book. It's the telephone again, you know. Gee, I probably shouldn't tell you this, but none of your other friends will tell you, but I saw your husband a week ago with... Well, thank you for telling me. No, I'm not angry. No, I know you're a friend. Yes, it's good to... I'm very glad you told me. Thank you so much for telling me. This is almost mythic in its pattern. It's the way this works. But what Shakespeare understood is the real source of it is not external. It's in here. Othello's doing all the work. The source of it's in here. Our own mistrust. Our own fears, our own doubts, even about those we love. Which is basically a reflection of our own fears and doubts about ourselves and Why will an Othello fall for this? Because he's so aware of his own weakness. He participated in stealing her away. He exaggerated those stories to make her fear and quiver so she'd fall in love with him. He's been a participant. And he's also black. He's an outsider. He's not one of them. He doesn't know how Venice operates. Fortunately, he's got a good friend. I am bound to thee forever. Yep, and it's a match. It's a match. The tempter's got him nailed. Tempter got him. And they are one now. I am bound to thee forever. Look at this. Iago responds, I see this hath a little dashed your spirits. I just told you that you better keep an eye on your wife because she's probably an adulteress. Oh, did that upset you? I see this hath a little dashed your spirits. Not a jot, not a jot. Trust me, I fear it has. I hope you will consider what is spoke comes from my love. But I do see you are moved. I am to pray you not to strain my speech to grosser issues, nor to larger reach than to suspicion. Now, don't make too much of this. Don't go overboard with this. I will not. Should you do so, my lord, my speech should fall into such vile success, which my thoughts aim not. Was my worthy friend. My lord, I see you are moved. No, not much moved. I do think, but Desdemona's honest. Long live she so, and long live you to think so. Oh, it's just awful. We're all laughing. And yet, how nature erring from itself. Othello has learned enough about Christian doctrine that he knows nature is fallen. And nature can indeed depart from that which is the best in it. He's right. It hasn't happened in the case of his wife. Not in this case, not in this suspicion. Aye, there's the point, as to be bold with you, not to affect many proposed matches of her own clime, complexion, and degree, whereto we see in all things nature tends. Like tends to like. She's a Venetian. She's a white Venetian. She should have married a white Venetian. That's the logic of it. Foe, one may smell in such a will most rank. Foul disproportion, thoughts unnatural. She didn't marry a white Venetian. She married a black Moor, he says to the black Moor. The very fact that she married you shows there's something a little suspect in her nature. Why does it work? Because the black Moor feels himself an outsider. The black Moor feels himself, why did she love me? Why did she turn down all those fellows? Why did like leave like? Maybe there is something suspect in her will. Maybe she is a little... In fact, she revolted against her father. She revolted against all those young matches she could have made in Venice. But pardon me, I do not in position distinctly speak of her. I'm just talking about Venetian women in general. He says, having just spoken specifically of her. But of course, Othello at this point is not about to follow a logical argument. Though I may fear her will, recoiling to her better judgment, may fall to match you with her country forms and happily repent. But look, I'm a little worried. Eventually she's going to compare you with some of those good Venetian men, and she's going to be sorry she married you, black guy. He's insulting him openly to his face. Farewell, farewell. If more thou dost perceive, let me know. If you see more, let me know, because he can't trust his own eyes. He's saying to Iago, you be my eyes now. I don't know what's going on. I can't see. I have no idea. What do I know? Set on thy wife to observe. Leave me. Have your wife. Okay. Now, there is, I'm skipping over. Again, I'm skipping over. The man goes into torment. Torment. Talks about Iago's honesty. Speaks of his own blackness. And how he is not civilized like all those Venetians. fears that his wife has appetites that he cannot control. And remember, what's he been most fearful of? What's he been trying to avoid? The flesh. It has made him uncomfortable. This has been a spiritual marriage, a high marriage, a marriage of soul and mind. What Iago is reminding him is, she's a woman, she's fleshly, she has appetites. He is haunted. Desdemona comes in. He sees her and cannot believe it. If she be false, heaven mocked itself. I'll not believe it. The very appearance brings him back to a sense, as some moment of sense. She sees he's upset. She thinks she's unwell. Out comes the handkerchief. She tries to wipe his forehead. He knocks it away. The handkerchief falls to the ground. And now we have the proof, which is nothing. The handkerchief is spoken of over and over again in this play, and the reason it is so overwhelming is precisely because it is nothing. He's already built the case. Emilia finds the handkerchief. Her husband's been asking her to get something. She gives the handkerchief to Iago. The handkerchief becomes the proof. It's nothing. It's nothing other than what Othello will turn it into. Okay? I'm leaping ahead. I'm past the point. Emilia's given the handkerchief to Iago. She has exited. Othello has re-entered. These are wonderful lines. I just have to say them because I love them. Enter Othello, and Iago says, look where he comes. I'm in the still same scene, the next entrance of Othello. Look where he comes. Not poppy, nor mandragora, nor all the drowsy syrups of the world shall ever medicine thee to that sweet sleep which thou owedst yesterday. You slept well last night, didn't you? You're never going to sleep that well again. Not even if you take drugs. Okay? Not even Tylenol PM will do it. Ha, ha, false to me. Avant, begone, thou hast sent me on the rack. I swear it is better to be abused than but to know it a little. How now, my lord? What sense had I of her stolen hours of lust? Look how he's talking now. Within the space of about 200 lines. I saw it not, thought it not, it harmed not me. I slept the next night well, fed well, was free and merry. I found not Cassio's kisses on her lips. It's gone. The imagination. The imagination hooked into jealousy, building and building and building. He that is robbed, not wanting what is stolen, let him not know it, and he's not robbed at all. It's Brabantio, who's been robbed of his daughter, he says, who's sleeping soundly. They wake him up. He says, there's nothing wrong in my house. We're getting a repeated pattern. I'm sorry to hear this, Iago says. Now, I want to focus on this speech. I had been happy if the general camp, pioneers and all, had tasted her sweet body, so I had nothing known. Oh, now forever, farewell the tranquil mind, farewell content, farewell the plumed troops and the big wars that makes ambition virtue. Oh, farewell, farewell the neighing steed and the shrill trump, the spirit-stirring drum, the ear-piercing fife, the royal banner, and all quality, pride, pomp, and circumstance of glorious war. And, O, you mortal engines whose rude throats the immortal Jove's dread clamors counterfeit, farewell, Othello's occupation's gone. It's one of Shakespeare's great speeches. And there's something very curious happening there. In coming to fear that his wife is unfaithful, Othello says he's lost his occupation as a warrior. And we get that list of he's saying goodbye to the battlefield. He's saying goodbye to everything that defined the soldier's life in battle. Why? Why? The connection is a real one. The word virtue sits there near the middle of the speech, okay? And the big wars that makes ambition, virtue. The soldier is ambitious. He wants to go off and fight. He wants to fight in the big war. And it gives him the opportunity to do what? To be virtuous. So in saying goodbye to the battlefield and goodbye to the life of the soldier, he is saying goodbye to virtue. Now, you all know your Latin, and the root of virtue comes from manliness. And what Shakespeare understood was that just as it was wrong for Desdemona, the woman, the wife, to leave the house, which was her domain, it is wrong of the man of virtue to withdraw from the battlefield. That man exists to go out in the world and fight for that which is good. If the domain of woman is in the house, the domain of man is outside the house. And what the woman does is maintain order and purity and decency and love in the home, and the man fights for the good outside the home. But the two are linked in marriage. The marriage of man and wife is the linking of the internal, the domestic, and the external, the professional, let's call it. Now what's happened is Desdemona has left the home and become his fair warrior. And suddenly he's now obsessed about domesticity. What is she doing privately? And the moment that enters his head, he can no longer be a warrior. Why? Because a man can only go and fight for virtue and be manly if he believes firmly he is defending the good. And if, and I'm going to use the word because it's the next phrase he uses. Iago says, "Is it possible, my lord? Why are you in such a passion? What, do you mean this? Villain, be sure thou prove my love a whore." She has just gone from being the pinnacle of beauty and all that is wonderful, and now he's saying, you better prove she's a whore. No man will go out and fight and put his life on the line to defend a whore. It's a harsh word. He has just used it about his wife. If he believes she is false, all order has fallen. And at that point, what happens to the muscled arm and the sword? It falls. I should go fight for what? Civilized order, moral decency, depends on a strong, virtuous man to defend it. But that man must believe at the most basic in the virtue of his own wife. If the woman becomes whorish, the man loses the ability to fight for the good. I just defined the modern world for you in one of its principal problems. When the women abandon chastity, chastity in marriage, virtue in marriage, no man's going to fight for anything. Fight for what? Why? So my wife can sleep around? So she can divorce me and take a second husband, a third husband? So my daughter can get an abortion? Fight for what? Civilized order depends on the chastity of the woman. And we go back once again to that decision the woman must make. All Christian civilization depends on the decision made by one woman. When the question was put to her, okay? This is the blessing that's come to you. This is God's plan. And the Blessed Mother says, be it done to me according to His will. And indeed grants in all humility, that God's will be done. And at that moment, the world changes forever. In the same way, Othello's soldiership depends on the humility, decency, and purity of his wife. Now here's the nightmare. Desdemona made a mistake in going around her father's wishes. That was wrong. But she is a decent, pure, good wife. He is throwing away his soldiership through misunderstanding. He's wrong. She is not any of these things, but enough doubt is there, it's generated now in his misunderstanding. I won't go through the rest of this. You'll see Olivier do it tonight. It's unbelievable. Iago now just builds and builds and builds on this, just weighs Othello down, crushes him, and starts, feeds the sickness that's in the imagination now. The scene ends. I just want to go to the very end of the scene, about the last 20 lines. He suddenly starts screaming, "Oh, blood, blood, blood." I mean, he is not a virtuous soldier on the battlefield. He's now a killer calling for blood. And that's what we're going to have by the end of the play. And the battlefield is going to be the marriage bed. That's going to be the battlefield where the blood spilled. "Oh, blood, blood, blood. Patience, I say, your mind may change. Never, Iago, like to the Pontic Sea, whose icy current and compulsive course never keeps retiring ebb, but keeps due on to the Propontic and the Hellespont. Even so, my bloody thoughts, with violent pace, shall never look back, never ebb to humble love, till that a capable and wide revenge swallow them up." We're back at that image of the storm at sea. We have water imagery again, we have a storm, and he's using that image to describe this passion that's out of control now. And suddenly he kneels down. "Now by yond marble heaven, in the due reverence of a sacred vow, I here engage my words." He makes a vow to heaven that he'll kill his wife. But what do we get? "Do not rise yet," Iago says, and Iago kneels beside him. We now have a weird, sick marriage. We have two men kneeling side by side making a vow before heaven. "Witness, you ever-burning lights above, you elements that clip us round about, witness that here Iago doth give up the execution of his wit, hands, heart, to wronged Othello's service. I become a humble servant now of the man beside me." It's a mock marriage. It's a distorted, horrible marriage. "I will serve my lord," says the other partner kneeling by the side. Oh, man. "Let him command, and to obey shall be in me remorse. What bloody business ever. I'll do whatever he tells me to. I will love, honor, and obey." But there's a way in which they have been forced to this sick parody of marriage because Othello has... let me put it this way. We have that fragmentation of human nature that's taken place in the play. Othello pretending that he is all honor, nobility, purity, soul, wisdom. Iago saying, "No, no, no, there's only the animal, there's only flesh, there's only lust." And of course these two come together and marry, and now we have a completeness. But the completeness we have is flawed and fallen and human in its fallenness, and now about to go out and commit demonic acts. We have an inverted marriage. They rise, and Othello says, "I greet thy love." Please notice, so far in this play, all the way through, we've had all these images of marriage, 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 marriage that's not quite working. Now we have one that works. Whew. It's inverted. "I greet thy love, not with vain thanks, but with acceptance bounteous, and will upon the instant put thee to it. Within these 3 days, let me hear thee say that Cassio's not alive." My friend is dead.
'Tis done at your request.
But let her live.
Damn her, lewd minx. Oh, damn her. Damn her. Come, go with me apart. I will withdraw to furnish me with some swift means of death for the fair devil.
The fair warrior is now a fair devil.
Now art thou my lieutenant.
I am your own forever. Chills. It's just awful. But I got to tell you, I go back to where I began the lecture yesterday. Nobody understood human nature better. Nobody. But what he's done is taken really what can happen in a relationship over time and squeezed it down to about 20 minutes. Just following the process of deterioration. You, as seminarians and young priests, are going to meet couples who are in the, you know, passions out of control. Passions out of control. The marriage that is supposed to be the source of comfort, joy, once it goes sour, this is what you've got. Horrifying. I've got just a couple minutes. There's one other thing I'm going to look at very quickly. In Act 3, Scene 4. I'm at line about 50. A scene between Othello and Desdemona. And he asks for the handkerchief. She's lost it. She doesn't know where it's gone. I have it not about me. Not, no indeed, my lord. That's a fault. Look, watch the following speech closely. That handkerchief did an Egyptian to my mother give. She was a charmer and could almost read the thoughts of people. She told her, that is the Egyptian told his mother, she told her while she kept it, 'twould make her amiable and subdue my father entirely to her love. But if she lost it or made a gift of it, my father's eye should hold her loathed and his spirit should hunt after new fancies. She, dying, gave it me, and bid me, when my fate would have me wive, to give it her. I did so, and take heed on it. Make it a darling like your precious eye. To lose it or give it away were such perdition as nothing else could match. Is it possible, Desdemona says.
'Tis true, there's magic in the web of it. A sibyl that had numbered in the world the sun to course 200 compasses, in her prophetic fury sowed the work. The worms were hallowed that did breed the silk, and it was dyed in mummy, which the skillful conserved of maidens' hearts. We have a magic charm. We have a talisman that's the only thing that will hold their love together. And if the magic charm goes, the love is gone. Do you remember back in the first act, Brabantio makes the accusation against Othello, he only could have won her love by magic. And at that point it seemed nonsensical because that wasn't the case, and what we had was a man wooing a woman. A newly converted Christian wooing a Christian woman who had fallen in love. Please notice what's happened. That's all been stripped away and the hero has reverted to his roots. He is now the Moor again. He's African. And love is the result of magic and talismans and charms and handkerchiefs dipped in mummies' hearts. This powder made of the hearts of young maiden. This is sheer superstition. This is nonsense. But Othello's becoming, if you will, a black African again, a real Moor, and believing in things that his people believed in. Okay, an Egyptian gave it to my mother, and she gave it to me, and I gave it to you, and you better not lose it because the charm will be gone. This is not the same man we met in Act 1. This is a man who has lost all of those things that defined him as Venetian, as Christian, as moral, upright, and good. It's all going. But of course, what's happened is that civilized order is being destroyed. The defender of the civilization has said, I can no longer fight. I'm no longer a warrior. Venice no longer has someone to defend it. Venice is gone. Civilization is gone. And when all that goes away, what do we get back to? The bare roots of the African. Tribal. Superstition. People behaving the way tribal people behaved centuries ago. Wearing rings in their ears, rings in their nose, rings in their lips, listening to pounding rhythms. Not defending their women, not believing in their homes, sleeping around. Meet Othello. He is us. I'll see you this afternoon.